should be income, so far as it reflects potential consumption. Right? So it reflects the resources that are available to the households for facilitating current consumption or acquiring assets. Again, the Canberra report also concludes that income is the appropriate one to use for most practical policy purposes. So now it should be stressed that the term well-being has much more broader connotations and a long history in the psychology literature, which I'm not going to deal with that here. Our use of the term is actually quite narrow, and it simply refers to a broader measure of the ability to acquire or have access to goods and services. Now, in other broader measures, like most of you probably are familiar with the Human Development Index, right, which also, if you look at it, you see that there is a measure of economic well-offness, if you want to call it that, which is the per capita GDP. If you look at some of the composite measures of economic well-being, which has been proposed in the economics literature recently, you will again find that there's something that reflects some measure of economic well-offness. By that, it does not mean that the other dimensions of human well-being are unimportant or that doesn't matter. But our focus here is on that component of overall human well-being, which we think is economic well-being that's crucial to determining the living standards of people. Now, of course, the income metric, as we are saying here, it suffers from some well-known limitations, right? But I still believe that there are some fundamental reasons why we would want to look at it. First, as I said before, it figures in other broader measures. So developing a better measure of access to goods and services can contribute to the empirical study, for example, of the relationship between entitlements and capabilities, as in the approach that's pioneered by Amartya Sen, or between resource availability and perceived well-being, as is often the case in new and now fashionable subjective approaches to well-being. The other reason is that we live in a world, as was eloquently portrayed by the, mentioned by the previous speaker, where large multitudes of people are deprived of command or access to basic goods and services. So it's an important thing to measure that and have so quantifying the relation between deprivation and inequality of access to products is a crucial component in battling such deprivation and inequalities, I believe. Now, the differences, so while these are like very general concepts between our metric, the Canberra report, and the conventional views, the differences between our approach and the standard approaches becomes clear when we begin to consider the scope, that is, what is included in this measure, what do we mean by goods and services, and the method, that is, by the way we calibrate the different goods and services over which the axis which we are trying to measure. So let me just start with a highlight of what are the components of this measure. Right, so in a modern capitalist economy, now the measure is, of course, the earlier definitions were at a very abstract level, but the actual measure has to take into account the particularities of a country or a society that you're trying to actually deal with. So in any modern capitalist economy, the bulk of the products, of the social product, exists in the form of commodities, that is, things that can be bought and sold for money. Right, so the most restrictive approach to measuring economic well-being is to say that, look, we are only going to look at the command over commodities. So what are the things that usually appear there? There is income from wealth, all other cash income, which can enable the purchase of commodities. Then there is, of course, taxes, which kind of subtract from the ability of the households to acquire commodities and commodities. And in the U.S. and in other developed capitalist economies, government non-cash transfers. In the U.S., we are primarily talking about medical care, or in the other developed capitalist economies, it's universal medical insurance that's there. The non-cash labor income, again, is an important component which gives you command over commodities. But even at this very restrictive level of the concept of economic well-being, there are major differences between Lemieux and the money income measure, the standard measure that's used. The latter takes the the actual income, actual current income from current assets, property income in the form of dividends, interest, and rent, as the measure of income from wealth. We don't do that. We take a different approach, as I will discuss in a minute. But it's also important to look at things which, although maybe some doing some injury to English, I'll call non-commodities, or things that are not bought and sold for money. And here, what are we talking about? Public provisioning, which was again mentioned in the previous discussions that we had. Here we are talking about public provision of healthcare, education, transportation, and so on. And there is also self-provisioning, which is household production, people providing for themselves and the members of their household. So this is the overall concept with which I'm working and with which I'm trying to approach the question of the measurement of economic well-being. Okay, so let me explain briefly why I said the standard measure of income from wealth is inadequate. Because in the standard money income measure, what is there is the current income from assets, like we said. But it does not reflect the advantages from asset ownership completely. And I think it does not also reflect the burden of debt completely. Some assets, typically homes that you live in, or retirement assets, as is the case in most developed capitalist countries, they don't yield any current income. So it's not reflected in any current flow of income that you get. But it's hard to imagine that differentials among households in economic security or well-being does not, you know, for that, these things do not matter, that is, retirement assets and homes. Similarly, ownership of substantial amount of financial assets gives you something more than just income from dividends or interest. We know that it confers on wealth holders substantial amounts of political and economic power. So if you are interested in having an economic well-being measure that reflects that type of inequalities in the society, then one needs to approach the income from wealth in a different way than just taking the standard approach. For significant number of households that are at the bottom of the economic ladder, the burden of debt or people with negative net worth, that's a serious problem. Again, the conventional measure does not reflect it in any way. So our approach, the guiding logic, was to construct a measure that would reflect the potential consumption from wealth in the current year, right? That could be sustained over the potential lifetime of the household. So the way we did it was to take separate out wealth into basically two components, home wealth, that is, owner-occupied homes, the value of that, and then non-home wealth. So for the home wealth, we took the approach that is taken in national income accounting. Housing is a universal need, so the advantage or the value of such services from housing were reckoned in terms of the gross imputed rent. Now, owning a house also means, at least in most financialized capitalist economies, it means also holding substantial amounts of debt in the form of mortgages. So you take that out to get the income from, take that out of gross imputed rent to take to arrive at the home wealth, income from home wealth. Income from non-home wealth, we are doing it as an annuity, annuitizing the value of wealth to arrive at a measure of sustainable consumption from wealth. I'm not going to ignore that. Let me show what were the things that were included in wealth. And this is like the standard list of assets that are included in the wealth definitions. Okay, so wealth, then the next consumption thing that is different about the scope of LEMU is public consumption. Now, we are drawing on two strands of literature here. The first group of studies is concerned with expenditure benefits or benefit incidence, where the central question is how the size distribution of personal income is altered by government expenditures on public provisioning, right? Expenditures on education and health and so on. Now, there's a second group of studies which looks at the social wage and focuses on how such expenditures alters the functional distribution of income between capital and labor. We're drawing on both these strands of literature. World Bank itself conducts a great deal of benefit incidence studies. So these are the kinds of literature from we are drawing from. Now, in both instances, the aim is to arrive at the ultimate distribution of actual or exposed distribution of economic well-being across income groups or social classes after accounting for taxation and public spending. Now, our overall approach is that of an accounting exercise. What this means, first of all, is that our focus is on public provisioning activities that supply products that could be directly used by households. Our estimate of benefit is really the cost incurred by the government in providing those services. Second, we do not allocate all expenditures to households. Some type of expenditures results in products that do not directly expand the consumption possibilities of households at all. We can think about defense expenditures, expenditures on prisons and so on, the main purpose of which is to keep the ship of state afloat. Third, we try to capture the geographic disparities that exist in public provisioning. And finally, we are using indicators of usage at the level of the household or groups of household to capture how the usages of public services differ among households. So just to give you an idea about, the actual implementation of the approach, of course, was much more detailed than as you can probably imagine. The logic of the approach can be illustrated by these three functions of government expenditures, right? So if you look at highways, we take the total expenditures of government on highways, we allocate a portion of that expenditure to households based on the share that passenger vehicles are responsible for in the total expenditures on highways. This comes from engineering economic studies. People who run the highway systems do these studies, and our estimates come from there. It's not something that we constructed. So that allows us to split the total expenditures on highways between households and others. Then to split that total among households, we estimate from surveys of personal transportation how many vehicle miles people drive. People in different income groups, people are differentiated by where they live. Then that amount then is allocated or distributed among vehicle-owning households, people who own vehicles, in a particular income group, in a particular state of the United States. The other function, if you look at that education, that's entirely allocated to the households, unlike highways, which is split between households and other sectors. Again, that total amount is then distributed among students, again, depending on the geography, depending on whether they are enrolled in public schools or not, and depending on what income group that they belong to. The third and the final one that I'll just mention briefly is the recreation expenditures on parks and so on. Those things are distributed equally among households. So there are three different types of functions here. Okay, let me go to the third one, which is household production, which again distinguishes the measure from the standard approaches to measuring household economic well-being. Now, the idea that household production results in products that expands the potential consumption of household members is not controversial. The importance of household production for economic well-being is quite established in the economics literature. With the availability of time use survey data from the 1960s onwards, there have been a large number of studies that have estimated the value of household production as well as augmented family income measures that includes the value of household production. That is income plus the value of household production. And I believe that Indira talked earlier about time use survey and about the methods of doing it. Now, the type of provisioning activities that are included here, since Indira has already probably discussed this, not going to spend much time on it, basically three main categories of activities, what are called core activities, and then the childcare activities and procurement or shopping activities. So the next question is about valuation, right? Now, the standard neoclassical approach is to use an estimate of foregone wage. Again, if Indira has already gone through it, I don't want to spend too much time. Indira, did you already discuss these different approaches? Okay. So these are the three main approaches. All of them are based on what we observe, can be estimated, based on what we observe in the time use data regarding how people spend their time on these different activities. What the method that we chose was the third one, that is the replacement cost based on the average wage of a private household worker, or the household made wage method, as it's sometimes called. Now, The replacement cost, it was used in 1990s by a UNDP study conducted for the Human Development Report Office, that this is what they used, on the grounds that the labor performed by this type of worker offers the closest match in terms of the labor processes involved in the household production. But a set of difficulties, not discussed widely enough in the literature, emerges when we consider that by adopting this method, what we are actually doing is to set the unit price of the product of household labor equal to the replacement, to the wage rate of the private household worker. So it's perhaps best to consider that as an unadjusted price of the product of household labor. Now, if you pursue that line of reasoning, then it emerges that, you know, some adjustments are required to account for the real differences that exist among households due to the heterogeneity of the output of what comes out of household labor, as well as to the quality and the efficiency of the labor time spent by different individuals. While this is an area that requires much more extensive research, the available evidence, as far as to my knowledge, suggests that these differences, this heterogeneity of output, the quality and the efficiency differences, are tied to the resources available to the households, that is income and wealth and so on, and the characteristics of individuals who are doing the household production, that is their education, for example. Now, we try to capture these differences by doing some adjustment to the standard replacement cost approach. So the letter A there is a function of the factors that we thought affect the heterogeneity and efficiency variations among households. We can talk about, if you have questions about how actually, you know, the mathematics behind how we constructed it. But the idea is to have a discount or a premium, the factor that would discount or, you know, increase the wage that is attached to a particular person's time spent on household production. Okay, let me now turn to the overall measurement framework and then present some estimates. So if you start from the left-hand side, the top box on the left-hand side, so we start from with the gross money income, which is the standard measure that is used here. We take out of that the government cash transfers. I'm going to include that later. And also property income, because like we discussed before, property income does not reflect adequately the advantage from wealth. So once you take that out, you get something called base income. We call it base income. It's primarily labor earnings. Once you take out property income and government cash transfers, what's there is labor earnings, to which we add the imputed rent or income from home wealth. And again, we add the imputed annuity or income from non-home wealth. And the third item, or the fourth item that is shown on the right-hand side box, is net government expenditures, which is really a measure of the cost of government services, either public provisioning or direct transfers, payments, flow of purchasing power from the government to the households, and net of what flows out from the household sector to the government in the form of taxes. That's what gives you the net government expenditures. Adding household production or the value of household production to it gives the LEMU. So that's how the LEMU is constructed. This is general measurement framework. Now, the statistical methods behind doing these things are somewhat involved, and we have several publications which discuss it. And if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer it. Okay. Now, these are the benchmark years for which we have constructed the measure for the United States. Currently, a research project is underway which tries to do this more or less the same thing for Canada, Germany, France, and UK, and maybe Spain. We don't know yet. But for these other countries, the effort is already underway. We're 1 year into that effort. But for the time being, I'll just talk about the U.S. results because this is the only thing that I have. Okay, so what's the overall rate of change if you look from 59 to 2004? How does it differ? Now, the growth in the median values, that's what's shown here, median household well-being is what's shown here. The annualized rates of growth for four sub-periods, 59, 72, 72, 89, and then the two other more recent sub-periods. And the last bars, that is the bars on the right-hand, extreme right-hand side, show the change over the entire period. Now, the growth in median economic well-being over the entire period appears to be much faster in terms of Li Mu than money income. Right? So if you look at these last two set of bars, right, the Li Mu is higher than the money income. So the annual growth rates, what it implies is that Li Mu in 2004 was about 50% higher than what it was in 1959 as compared to money income, which was about 30% higher. So it's a big difference in terms of judging the increase in the living standards depending on what measure you use. Now, both Li Mu and MI, or money income, show that that the growth in middle-class standard of living was stronger in 59-72 rather than in the period 72-89. But MI, or the money income, shows that there was a slowdown in terms of change in the average household standard of living after 1989, or during 72 to 89, I'm sorry. During 72 to 89 and 89 to 2000, money income shows that the rate of change was lower, while Li Mu shows the opposite. Right? So the trends in the standard of living are quite sensitive to what type of measure you use to measure standard of living. Now, let me take it. This shows in more detail what happened to the middle quintile, or the, what we call the middle class, in what generally called the middle class. Okay. So here we are looking at the rate of change in Li Mu and money income by different subperiods for which we have done the estimates. And you can see for the first subperiod, the total change in Li Mu was about 4.8%, right? That's what I'm pointing to here, what's under total, right? And the money income shows a much stronger growth for the middle class during what's generally described as the golden age of capitalism. So that early period, it does not appear so golden if you use Li Mu as the metric of economic well-being. It's much slower. And the reason for that can be seen by looking at what's happening with household production. So what's shown here in the entries in the column under Li Mu is the contribution of each of the major component of the measure to the overall change. Right? So as you can see, household production made a negative contribution to the change between 59 and 72. Yeah, what that means is that if you take the total change in Li Mu, right, we can express that as the contribution made by the different components to that total percentage change, right? So the household production, the value of household production was declining, yeah. That's what it shows.
More of it was becoming
commodified. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
So when it's bad, it's good. I'm just clarifying.
When it's bad, it's good.
Yeah, I mean, if there's less unpaid labor.
Well, it's not just less unpaid labor that matters, right? Because there's a valuation involved here. So it depends also on what happens to the unit value of household production, right? That depends on the wage that is used in valuing it. So if you look,
yeah, but if you look here, In the addendum, in the bottom, I don't know whether you can see this. You can't see it. Okay, so what that shows is the contribution made by the change in hours and the change in unit value. Okay. Yeah, there was. Yeah. There is a 19, yeah, we can talk about the data sources later, how we made up the numbers, yeah. But you are right, the data for time use is not exactly from 59. Yeah, but, so that's what it reflects, right? I mean, so half of that change
was due to change in the unit value in the first period, the 59 to 1972 period, and half of it was due to the change in hours, decline in the hours. And I'll present some data on how the hours changed between men and women in a moment. But okay. Now let me just mention briefly about what happened with the overall the change for the overall period, that is from 59 to 2004. And here you can see what we mentioned earlier, that Lemieux shows a faster rate of growth than MI, so the total change is higher. Now, if you look at why the total change is higher, the main reason why middle-class economic well-being appears to have improved more when you take Lemieux as that metric is mainly due to net government expenditures, that is, what governments spend for households, net of what households pay to the government, and due to household production, which contributes positively to the change in median economic well-being. Again, the household production, the primary factor that is driving that positive contribution by household production is the change in the unit value, which reflects the increase in the replacement wage, that is the wage of the private household employee over this time, right, from the real wage of the private household employee. So household production accounted for about 25% of the growth in middle-class economic well-being. Now, this happened in spite of an absolute decline in the number of hours that was spent on household production, and that's why I was saying that it was driven by the growth in the unit value. As you can see, the contribution of the hours is actually negative, but the increase in the unit value overwhelms that decline. Since I have only 15 minutes, I'm not going to spend much time talking about how this matters for inequality. That is, the pattern of inequality is sensitive to the measure that you use. What will drive the changes in inequality will depend on the metric that you use. Basically, the bottom line is that if you use money income, what will change inequality, what will drive the dynamics of inequality is the inequality in earnings, in labor income. If you use Lemieux, what is driving the growth in inequality will be income from wealth, inequalities in the ownership of assets. That's what will drive the trend in inequality. We can talk about it more again if we have time after the presentation. Okay, let me turn very quickly to some of the patterns in the hours of work, which I glossed over earlier. Now, this is showing the median values for households. So here I'm taking the household as a unit of analysis, because the earlier numbers that I presented were for households, right? So, you can see that there was a noticeable drop in the. The one on top here, that shows the total hours of work, and the reddish one or the purple one shows housework, and the other line, the bluish or the dark blue line, shows market work, or that means paid work, work in the labor market. Said, can you see?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. No, that's okay. So by our calculations, there was a noticeable drop in the median annual hours worked from 59 to 82. So that's about like 0.5% per year if you annualize the 59 to 72. Yes. After that, it went down a little bit more, but then it has rose a little bit. You know, up after 1982, it has increased just a little bit. Now, the 59 to 72 change, or 82 is more or less the same as 72, is primarily due to the large drop in hours spent on household production. In contrast, if you compare the 59-82 period and the period after that, in 82 to 89, you can see a jump in paid work that's happening, right? So the total work rose primarily because market work or work in the labor market. The total hours supplied to the labor market increased. there was little change between 89 and 2000, but between 2000 and 2004, you can see a sharp drop in the total hours worked, and that's primarily due to the decline in paid work, that is, in market work, right, the market. So that reflects the depressed conditions of relatively depressed conditions of the labor market in 2004 as compared to 2000. More details on the hours worked by persons are shown here. So it's clear that the large reduction in housework that we saw earlier between 1959 and 72 was attributable to a sharp drop in housework by women. So it dropped about 521 hours. So if you look here for housework for women, right, there's a huge drop. And it fell quite a bit, not as much as in the first period, that is between 59 and 72, but it again fell between 72 and 82, and then declined modestly since then, right? The opposite, sorry? No, you're seeing it absolutely right. It grows up dramatically for men, right? So there is a big change that is taking place in the patterns of housework in America during this period of time. Now, the big change that is happening, sorry? but the big change that is happening for women on the other side is the increase in paid work or in market work over this period, right? So women nearly doubled their hours of market work between 59 and 2004. Now the increase was fairly uniform across the sub-periods. Men, on the other hand, if you look at it, there is a decline in the hours of market work. From 59 to 82, there was a rather dramatic drop. And since then, it rose somewhat, but still it remains much below what was observed in 59. Right? Finally, let's take a look at the joint distribution of gender disparity and household income. Here, what is shown is... Let me back up. So what this is showing is the ratio of women's annual hours of housework to men's annual hours, the mean values. So ratio. This line is showing what it was for 1959. And what this is showing is what it was for 2007. So each point, by the decile of Lemieux, right? So... this is just for married couple households. So in 1959, you can see that there is a positive correlation between the gender disparity in housework and the rank of the household in the distribution, right? That is, the higher the rank of the household in the distribution, higher was the extent of gender disparity. Now, in contrast, in 2004, I'm sorry, it says 2007, but it's 2004, it seems to be pretty flat, right? The schedule of gender disparity is flat with respect to the rank of the household in the Lemieux distribution. I mean, apart if you ignore the first two deciles, right? For most of the distribution remains pretty flat. So why? What's going on here? You know, what accounts for this pattern? So let's take a look at this slide, right? Which shows, if it comes on, yeah. So in 1959, right, married men's housework, which is shown here in the bottom, right, it shows very little elasticity with respect to the rank of the household in the distribution. There's not really that much change, apart from at the very top. But for women, the rise is pretty steep. I'm sorry.
Whereas this graph, you can easily see the distinction between men and women, you know, by the different colors. The previous one,
yes.
Previous slide
was a ratio between men to women, and now I'm trying to explain why we saw what we saw with the ratios. So right? So we saw that the disparity between women and men, right? Women's housework as a multiple of men's housework begin to increase as you went up in the income distribution, right? Now, the reason for that is that men's housework remains fairly constant across the distribution. It shows very little variation, right, depending on where you are on the distribution. But whereas for women, there is a very sharp gradient here as you go up the income distribution, right? Sorry? Up to the, so, I'm sorry? The 10 is the richest, yeah. One is the lowest decile and 10 is the top decile, right? The top 10 of the. This is 1959. Yeah, that's right. So, right, so the. I'll show that in a minute. I'll show that in a minute, but. Okay. Yeah. No, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah. I can wait. I know that I'm going too fast and I'm putting up so many slides, so people need time to digest what's being said and to process what's being said. But what I was trying to explain was that why is it that the disparity, the gender disparity in household production, right, had a positive slope in 1959 and why it disappeared in 2004, right? What's going on here? So if you look at the 59 patterns, you can see that men's housework hours change very little across the deciles. If you look at 2007, I'm sorry, I have it as 2007, it's actually 2004, but in the latest year, or the later year, what happened is that there is a positive correlation, right? The elasticity is really positive, and it varies with the decile. So you can see that for women, it dropped a lot, right? The schedule actually dropped a lot. That is, the hours worked by women in housework dropped dramatically across the distribution. For men, there was a jump in the other direction, right? Across the distribution, it increased. But because the slopes of the line are kind of, the lines are running almost parallel to each other, that's why the gender disparity is flat when you come to the later year as opposed to the first year. Now, this requires more study and more investigation. This is results from current research that I'm doing. Now, the findings with respect to the gender disparity and its relationship to income distribution didn't appear to be sensitive to what we used as the measure of income, whether we use money income or LEMU. It didn't seem to matter. But that's not true for paid work. And I'll end with showing how it looks for paid work. Now, again, this is showing, as before we did for housework, this is showing the gender disparity in market work. Again, the ratio of women's hours of market work to men's hours. So the top line, or the line that looks relatively flat, is using for ranking households the LEMU, right? So here I'm trying to show how it is sensitive to what measure of income you use, the joint distribution of gender disparity in paid work and income, how that will be sensitive to the measure of income that you use. So as I said, the LEMU one is somewhat flat, doesn't show much variation when you compare it to the money income decile, where gender disparity actually falls the higher you go in the distribution of money income. And this is not very hard to understand, because one of the reasons why money income would go up is because women work. So if you have money income as your metric of economic well-being, the more women work, you know, in married couple families, if the women are working, then naturally that will be the reason that they will be pushed up in the ranking of the distribution. But that's not true for LEMU. And the reason for that is that the higher rungs of LEMU, the people in the higher rungs of LEMU, derive a disproportionate amount of their annual income from wealth. So once you account for that, the positive correlation that you see between gender disparity and paid work and income disappears. So again, it would matter how you measure economic well-being and how you account for particular things in it for what we commonly discuss with gender disparity in paid work. I'll stop there. Thank you very much. I'll skip this because there's more information if you want that's in there. Yeah.
Can you just explain again how you had the money income going up for the period?
Is there any order in which I take? Because this, the previous slide, I didn't talk about it.
So no.
Okay. Still put it on? Okay. Okay. So this is showing what is behind the ratios, right? So if you look at the, since you asked about it, shall I take a minute to say what it's showing or is it clear?
Okay.
All right. So what it's showing is if you look at the dark blue line, that is showing men's hours of paid work or market work and how that varies across the money income decile. Right? So you can see there is a very positive slope here, very steep positive slope, as one would expect, right? Because money income is primarily, it consists of labor income. The more hours you work, and once you go to the higher rungs, you're talking about full-time, full-year workers. Right? And for women, too, you can observe a similar slope, but it's not as steep as that of men. But you look at what the other two lines, which are much more flatter schedules, show the elasticity of hours with respect to Lemieux, when you use the Lemieux to rank the households in the distribution. And the reason why I was saying that the slope seems to be much flatter is that the higher rungs of Lemieux is not consisting of labor earnings or consists to a large extent of income from wealth. Yeah, so once you account for wealth, and there are other things also going on here because there is value of household production, which itself can help bump people from one decile to another. So suppose that you are a single mother who do not work at one point, right? So the Lemieux will have a value of the time that you spend on caring for your child as part of your annual income. Now, if you go to work and you make minimum wage or the wage of the replacement wage of the household worker, then your household, you know, your level of well-being will be unchanged according to Lemieux. Whereas according to money income, there'll be a big jump. Right? So that's what accounts for the lower elasticity of paid work. Let me just move to the slide. So there's some, I've listed some articles here, but really the best source is the Levy Institute, because not all of what I'm saying here is in the publications, but and the what's at the Levy Institute is available freely to everybody on the web. So yes, is there any particular? Do I take the questions or do you, somebody else moderate or? Did you have a question? I'm sorry. No?
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. I wonder what type of time use survey data did you use?
What type of time use survey data?
I mean, as far as I know, there is no time use data in 1959.
Yeah.
You started, maybe it's, you
it's
use
the time
16.
Use data for 1965.
Okay. Yeah. So heritage time use data.
Yes, exactly.
And then I don't know about that, whether they have, they asked both husband and wife.
None of the American time use surveys do that.
Yeah, so did you impute, did you use the imputed value for imputed hours of non-market work for men? If
No.
Yeah, you get the
haploid.
Yeah, but for the purpose of household measure.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, so.
But yeah, so the basic sampling frame, right, that we use mm-hmm. is the, for 1959, is the census micro data, do you know what I'm, IPAMS? Yeah, it's the IPAMS. So we statistically match each record in IPAMS with the record in the time use survey. Right? So the time use survey is not for all individuals in a particular household. Right? None of the time use surveys in the US
with the exception of one, I think, the 1985 one, which did it for some households, right, where they interviewed both husband and the wife in married couple households. So that's how the time use information is transferred from the time use survey to our basic sampling, basic sample.
Okay. The framework is, I mean, it's really intuitively appealing. Now, I'm trying to see some of the application of it in terms of national accounting. Mm-hmm. Is can it be really used in that setting? Because I know in most of our countries, for the national accounting system, you just balance, I mean, the account to obtain household income, for example.
Yeah.
And so a framework like this, it is intuitively appealing because if you want to disaggregate, for example, a social accounting matrix,
yeah,
then, it's a very nice framework to do that. Otherwise, you will have to use some kind of survey data on household and calibrate it with the social accounting matrix, and it is a mess. And this one, I believe, you have framework to. So can it really be used? This is the question I'm asking you. Can it really be used for national accounting? Now, the other thing is, have you tested the model? What is the predictive power of the model, of the framework? What I want to see is, if I have real data showing the well-being, figures, the real well-being figures, and you run the framework, you run the model, will you be able to obtain figures that are very close to the real figures?
Okay. Do I answer questions, or should I take more questions and answer them? Not zillions, I hope. I take or take them all? Okay. So then let me write down. Okay.
Next one.
Okay, I have a question,
Yeah.
Rich households have higher unpaid work, according to this. One of the reasons could be that the work participation rates in these households is lower, and that's why housewives are more in terms of percentage, and they use time in a leisurely fashion. And that brings to the other question that you don't account for productivity. The one major limitation of input method is that you don't account for productivity. So if somebody is stretching time doing the same thing, then your value will be higher than somebody who is compressing that work within a short time. Will it be that? So that creates a problem in valuation in that case?
Ajit, this is absolutely fascinating stuff. So thanks a lot. It was really excellent. But I have to confess, there's a little bit of disquiet. And it's not only because I have to... Oh, you see, my joke is no longer valid. Sorry, let me just begin.
You can still say it.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to, which is, what is the difference between Santa Claus and the new man?
New?
The new man, the new man.
Yeah.
Yeah? Huh? Yeah? Santa Claus does exist, right? So, except that now I can't say that if this is true and, men are doing all this housework and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
No, but so listen, I'll tell you, there are two... If you go back to one of your earlier graphs, you have this thing of how Lemieux incomes are going up when the mean incomes, the nominal incomes are falling, in the 80s and 90s and so on and so forth later on. Now, the thing is, that's right, this one. Yeah, this is it. Now, the light blue stuff is what we've all got used to, right? Bob Pollin and Dean Baker, and everybody's told us how everything got horrible, Reagan onwards, okay?
Yeah.
You're saying it didn't, it got better. Now, I'm wondering how much of that is because of the change in asset values, which is to say stock markets and real estate, mm-hmm. which inflates your wealth figures, and which therefore I don't think is such a great thing. And how much of it is unpaid labor? Because I'm deeply uncomfortable with unpaid labor being seen as a positive aspect of economic well-being. You know, so I'm uncomfortable with that. And so, you know, I'm wondering whether, you know, that is what is influencing this, in which case maybe we should rethink how you're doing the Lemieux, because what you're doing is putting a positive spin on unpaid labor. You know, so that do you see what I mean? I'm not sure how one assesses it.
Okay. Yeah, just that point, that is there a valuation of unpaid work, and then what wage rate, for instance, is used? Is it the same? I don't know if it is a given wage rate is used to value hours of household production.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
A kind of valuation
yes.
of the hours of unpaid work, so the household production hours, is there a valuation
yes.
to change it to income, to give it an income value? Is there a valuation?
Yeah.
Yeah, now what did you use? Is it wage rate? What wage rate do you use for the valuation?
Okay.
And then do you use the same wage rate for low-income women in the lower decile and those in the higher decile?
Okay.
The opportunity cost of their time would definitely be different.
Okay.
In this chart, the first bar, for the first period, does it mean that money income is higher than Lemieux?
No, this is just the percentage change.
Percentage
annual
change.
Rates of change.
Okay.
It says on the top of the slide.
I think there have been a couple of studies talking about how childcare hours have significantly increased, time spent on childcare at home.
Yeah.
Again, amongst upper income, there's sort of very exclusive attention to the child, and you know, you're grooming them for like the Ivy League or whatever it is, and driving them here and there. So that sort of that whole focus on childcare has become so intense, and there's a sort of method of parenting which is very different, both from lower income households as well as the past.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably have a break, so you probably know where the increase in household work is coming from, whether it's the shopping or the childcare. So I was wondering if you saw any of that, because I think there's been something recently trying to link that to the rising cost of education and education access and inequality in access to education in the U.S., higher education.
Mm-hmm.
This unpaid work part is very interesting. Indeed, I want to ask, is there a place for the third party in this unpaid work? Who is the caregivers? I mean, now in recent times, now women work outside and they delegate their work now to other women, their grandmother, their mothers, or some migrant women coming from outside. Does this approach capture this too?
So it's a question about whether, I'm sorry, can I just clarify what, is the question about do we include in the hours of household production the care that is given by other parties? Outside of the household, or? Okay.
Yeah. I just have. I have a question. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was interesting because you had this chart where it seemed to indicate that the richer you are, more hours you work, both men and women. And of course, from the labor point of view, if you work excessive hours, that's not really being in a well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, exactly. So I don't know how we can reconcile that. And then you had a kind of more flat, I think it was a ratio of, now I'm a bit confused. I think, was it,
let
you had
just,
a chart?
Let me just go quickly there. I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
was it this one? Housework or market work? Which is the one that you're talking about?
It was talking about market work, yeah. Right.
Yes.
That must be the one.
So where this is showing the annual hours of market work in 2004.
Right. That means it correlates. I mean, as you become richer, because that's the income bracket, right?
Those are the income deciles. That's
so it seems to indicate the richer you are, more hours you work.
Yeah. In terms of paid work. Yeah.
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 In a way, it does make sense. On the other hand, I mean, excessive hours is not equivalent to being in well-being. I mean, in a good, how can I say?
Yes.
That's,
Yes, what it says, but there's a physiological study of work.
Sorry? Maybe the other ones are underemployed. It's also possible. So this is just a question I have. Yeah, I have a question here. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I will echo a bit of a previous question. I don't remember if it was Indira or Jayati that made the point. There is a bit of a conflict here. On the one hand, when I think of unpaid work and time use, from a feminist perspective, from a heterodox perspective, I want to argue that it is contributing to society, it is contributing to well-being of families, and it should be measured and it should be counted. But I belong to the school that actually I know some of my colleagues sitting on this side of the table do not necessarily agree with, but I belong to the school that says less paid work is not good for women. More unpaid work is really bad for women. So on the one hand, when I have women contributing a lot of their time in unpaid work, I know that the nation is wealthier for that, all the more the wealthier. I know that many times households survive on the basis of women's unpaid work. But I don't think of that as something good for women. I think of it as something good for families, good for the nation, because we are producing a lot. But it is not necessarily good for women. So the measure says, if I have a cut in healthcare expenditures, and now women are filling in the gap, economic well-being, for example, let's say that it is proportional, the reduction of government expenditures, the filling in of the gap by women's work, your measure would say households are equally well off as they were before. But from my perspective, households are, because perhaps, the father got sick, the grandfather got sick, somebody was there to take care of them, HIV, AIDS people are being taken care of as well, perhaps not as well as they would be in a hospital, but women suffer from it. So, yes, the LIMU shows me something about household well-being, but not women versus men's well-being. I had exactly the same problem with my colleagues that presented their work on taxation. These are household measures. The analysis is done at the level of the household. But I don't know what is happening between men and women. So do you have any plans, as I have been asking this question, Ajit, for the last 4 years? I am very proud of all of you that included unpaid work in your measure, that somehow you are including it, you're not saying that well-being is independent of it. But how do we deal, how do you transition from that to the intra-household bit so that I can see at the individual level for men and women what is happening? Do you plan to downgrade, for example, have an adjustment coefficient so that when it is women's work, we can have the well-being of the household increasing but the well-being of women decreasing, something like that. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we have this. I mean, I agree with my sister, Tumaira.
left.
What a surprise.
Shocked. You're shocked.
But you don't agree with your brother.
And I was just thinking, how can, was there a way to do that? And then she just said adjustment coefficient. And what I was going to say that, if can there be an adjustment for, you know, somehow widening disparity within the household the same way that you do for the... Yeah, the same way you do it. So that if we have two situations that we are comparing between, you know, the example that she gave, you know, the healthcare expenditures were cut off and then the women came and filled in the flag, whatever. So people got the same kind of care, but under this different arrangements of work. Right? And this increased the unpaid work of women and made the kind of contributed disparity in terms of unpaid work. Or you can have a situation where, yes, the state didn't do it, but it was men and women equally took on that burden. And we should be able to differentiate between that. So the answer might be, and I was thinking exactly the same thing when she said coefficient. To what direction? To what direction? Okay, I will ask my sister Cynthia this question. And you will be banned from speaking for the rest of this session. Cynthia will speak. Adam? In what direction? Susan, 20 women jump on him. Yeah. So some kind of adjustment, downward adjustment for this, or some kind of coefficient that indicates that.
Can you go? Can you go back real quickly to the housework decomposed like this?
I'm sorry.
With the money income, this same slide for the housework.
Oh, housework. This one?
Yeah.
This one, the disparity. This one. Or the previous one? No, no. He wanted to go.
Wanted
no, to
I
go
just
back.
Wanted to see this one.
Oh, you just wanted to see it. Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. okay. I won't even try to pretend that I can answer the questions here, but I will partly pretend that I'm answering. Partly I will answer too, because some of these questions have come up in several discussions. You know where. We have presented this work and had discussions in the very beginning when we started this work itself. Several of the questions that you're raising now had come up at that point. So it's still coming up. That's a good sign. That's a good sign. That's a good sign. But I'll also tell you why it comes up. Why? What made us do what we do and what the decisions that we take. I can't go into all the details, but at least I'll try to give you a flavor of our thinking and where we're coming at it from this. Let me just go quickly in the order in which the questions were raised. And some of them are common, so I'll try to deal with them together. So if you feel that your question has not been answered or not, I'm still here tomorrow upstairs. So if you want to come by and talk, I'm more than happy to do it. But the first question was about national income accounting, whether this can be related to national income accounting, where the framework can be used for national income accounting. The short answer is that this is not meant to be that. It's meant to be a household level measure of income, really. So the concept is that of an extended income, right? That's the concept, really. So no, it's not meant to be constructed at an aggregate level. By principle, it is. Now, we do use a lot of national income accounting data in constructing the measure, But that's going the other way around, going from the national income accounting data to households, rather than trying to aggregate up from households. I mean, there are a whole host of issues as to why one wouldn't want to do it, and why one wouldn't even want to do what we are doing as a disaggregation of the household sector in Assam, right? The treatment of wealth is especially tricky, but so is the treatment of household production. It's not immediately obvious to me what one would gain by disaggregating Assam in the using the accounting framework that we have done, if that can be done. I doubt very much. Okay. The fitting of the data, I'm not sure whether I understood your question, but as far as I was trying to explain to you, that's a purely a measurement framework. There is no econometric estimation involved in it. I mean, these are just actual numbers measured at the level of each individual household. We use some econometrics and some statistics to get where we get, but they cannot be compared against any actual or, you know, real numbers, because that's the steps that we take in the imputation process itself. So, and we do it precisely because there are no real numbers. If it was there, we would use it. So it's the imputation technique involves some statistics and econometrics, but otherwise it's a strictly a measurement framework. It's not a forecasting or a fitting, you know, data fitting kind of exercise. The question that that Indira raised about productivity differentials among households, this, as you very well know, probably much better than I do, is a problem with time use data. I mean, there is no way to, you know, distinguish whether. Sorry. Yeah, but you know, the output measures are equally problematic, and there aren't any for US. All we have is time use data. So there is no way that I can directly account for it. But I thought that it was important, and that's why we tried to use this adjustment to the replacement cost. And this goes to the question that the colleague asked about, I can't see your name, but Bola asked about how we valued household production, right? So what we used was the standard replacement cost method, but modified. And I indicated what the modification was in a slide. Perhaps it was not clear enough. But the basic idea is to start with the average wage for private household workers, what in the US are called the private household workers, which are people who work in private households, in households, you know, maids, household maids, really, their wage, and then adjust that for each individual, depending on how that individual ranks, or the household that the individual lives, ranks in terms of household income, how that individual ranks in terms of time availability, which is another way of account, you know, indirectly capturing the productivity differentials, to include an index of time availability in it. There's this whole sociological literature on relationship between time availability and time use, right? So it's drawing on that insights from that literature. And also the educational attainment of the person measured as years of education. So there's a composite index which for each individual is constructed, right? So that's used to adjust the replacement wage for each individual. So we don't use the same wage for every individual. So other things remaining constant, higher your household income, the higher will be your wage. But it need not be the case, because a higher household income may be the result of you working more hours, in which case the index will pull it in the other direction. So it's not immediately obvious what the net effect will be for any given household, although we have some stuff in our reports which shows the sensitivity of this to different ways of doing it. So that's about the valuation. Let me answer all the questions about housework, since I'm on that topic. Somebody asked a question about childcare hours. Okay. So, yeah, if you look at the overall pattern of how housework have changed, you know, if you look at household production hours by women, that has fallen dramatically, right? So, I mean, within that, if you go by the latest numbers, the bulk of the weekly hours, like about 65%, is on what we call as core production, which is cooking, cleaning, etc. And then the rest is kind of equally split between, on the average, between care and procurement, shopping. Right? So there has been some, over time, there has been some shift in the allocation of time towards childcare. But on the average, it doesn't show up much. But of course, if you look at particular segments of the population, like married couple, house families, then you do see an increase. In the Yeah, the composition, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, this is match data. It's a synthetic data set. So I don't believe in splitting it by so many different activities, you know, the household production hours into different components and looking at it for small groups like desires of household. It's not, you know, the statistical reliability of that is I won't put much faith in it. I can do it with my data. It's easy to churn out the numbers, but I don't really trust them that much. The other question again on childcare, there was a question here about the care work done by others. Is that included or not? No. The hours of household production that are valued are the time spent on household production, including care, by people who live in that household. So if, for example, a member of the household is a grandmother, and that grandmother helps take care of the children, then that will be captured in the measure. So if a babysitter comes and watches your child for a couple of hours or 3 hours when you go out for a movie, that won't be captured here. But that will be captured for the babysitter as his or her income in the measure, right? So, okay, again, the unpaid work, Rania's point about a lot of unpaid work being not good for women, right? I don't claim that. I mean, there's no assumption about it. The approach is informed by the very starting point as to what is the concept of economic well-being that's being used, right? So like I said, this is an extended income measure. So if you're trying to measure the access that people have over products, right, the concept is constructed to capture that. And it doesn't say anything about whether you'll have a psychological breakdown working too many hours. Too much income may be bad for you, right? It may be. But that's really not what the measure is trying to do, because it's an income measure, really. So it suffers, yeah, in the... No, I don't take it as a criticism.
There is so much incredible work behind it. Is it possible now to go one more extra step that will also allow us to evaluate not household level, but individual?
Yeah, this is not easy. And this is not easy, because it's not just for household production, right? Because you're dealing with wealth, you're dealing with public expenditures, right? You're dealing with a number of components here. So, if I may just finish the first round of questions, then I can come back. Yeah. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying about adopting the as a unit of analysis, right? That's really the question. What do you adopt as the unit of analysis? And the unit of analysis that we have adopted in this study is the household, although a number of things are constructed from the individual level, like value of household production, each person's hours spent on household production is constructed before we aggregate it at the household level, right? But the measure itself, because a number of important variables that goes into the survey, like for example, expenditures on water and sewerage, which is there in the measure, right? The public expenditures on that, that's at the household level. Expenditures on vehicle miles driven by households, right? Public expenditure. Large amounts of public expenditures can only be thought about by their very nature, since a lot of it is local public goods, right? You cannot think about it as an individual level. It's hard to impute it, right? Wealth is another example, right? Income from wealth is another example. You think about housing stock, right? The services of owner-occupied homes. Again, it's very hard to allocate it among individuals. Yeah, So since the measure is constructed by using a number of components for which there is no directly economically reasonable way, I mean, apart from the statistical problem, there's no economically, in my view, there's no economic rationale for splitting several of the items among individuals in a household. Or there is, I mean, there can be some arbitrary rule. You can apply some arbitrary discounting factor or adjustment factor, but, you know, that's, I don't know whether that tells me really what's going on with intra-household inequality. If we want to do it, I think we don't have to necessarily take this approach. I mean, this is meant for a particular purpose. This is not suitable for everything. If you want to look at intra-household economic inequality, you need to look at something else, not Lemieux. Lemieux is constructed primarily as an alternative to official measures of economic well-being, which are household-level measures, right? That's the purpose for constructing it. And I, like I said, you know, also there are several conceptual and practical difficulties in thinking about number of the components at individual level. The question about, I guess the question about excessive hours of work, which was raised there about whether it's good for people, whether they work too many hours. Again, the well-being, I tried to elaborate when I began the presentation, I'm not using well-being in the broader sense of whether that's good for the person's health or physical health or mental health or anything like that. Like any income measure, it will have this feature, like all income measures have this flaw, that your income can be very high. I mean, there's Sen's famous example of the disabled person with a lot of income. We all know that, right? That does, how does that mean that the person is really well off or not? So that's, I mean, that's something that is, but even Sen's other approach, the Human Development Index, the what, or what, based on, roughly based on Sen's approach, again, has a measure of income in it. And I'm just saying that if, even if you want to go to a broad measure of well-being, you need to have a good measure of income. And Lemieux is trying to do that. Right? So it's not saying that that's the only thing that matters for human well-being. No. Jayati's question about the asset bubble. Okay. That I have to show the other graph. Yeah. This one right here, right? So if you look between 82... Okay, if you look between 82 and 89, the growth in money income for the middle class was about 12.2%, right? The Lemieux is 21.3. So this is what I was saying earlier, and I think which you were saying, that why is it that those years which shows stagnation or slow growth for money income, the standard measure, right? And as compared to Lemieux, what's going on, right? Sorry? Well, for I mean, that depends on the period, yeah, right? That depends on the period. So, well, that, by that, what do you mean by which period? I'm talking about 82, 89, yeah, right? Yeah. If you look at 82, 89, out of like the increase of 21.3% in Lemieux, income from wealth is 1.7. So it's a very small fraction.
No, it's, you have to look at the difference, right? So it's 21.3 minus 12.2. So it's...
yeah, but it's not, you know, it will hardly account for anything. It's basically the difference is due to household production. It's the growth in the unit value of household production that is driving the larger growth in Lemieux during 82-89. It's not income from wealth. Of course, we know that the asset bubble...
I've seen it. Look what's happening. Minus 2.1% in public consumption. And so there's so much more unpaid labor at home.
You're talking about this? This? That is taxes. That is taxes. Yeah. So, anyway, so if you look at... so what's happening between 82 and 89? I'm just trying to
the second question that you asked was about.
Okay, good.
Thank you.